postmenopausal women, when given a matriarchal position of caring for the community, of bringing up future generations, of passing on wisdom, wind up with an altogether different purpose in life that I think lends itself to longevity just as much as, say, the ability to or the inability to bear children. The most important thing when it came to longevity was relationships. And while that doesn't necessarily have to mean your own children, I think it does speak volumes about just community, friendships, and potentially family in general.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. So friends, are you ready to join me? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Friends, I am just smiling right now with so much gratitude. I have been following Ben Greenfield for years and years. He is one of the main figures in the biohacking movement and has had such a profound effect on my own journey in the world of biohacking. It was such an honor to sit down with him today. And Ben does a lot of podcasts, and I feel like today's conversation, we kind of covered some nuances that he doesn't typically talk about. In fact, one of the things we talked about, he said that nobody has ever asked him before on a podcast, or probably ever in general. I really think you guys are going to enjoy this conversation. We talk about things I love, like the role of wine in health and Ben's ultimate hangover protocol. We talk about whether or not having kids is good or bad for your longevity, how attractiveness relates to health, the importance of finding purpose, and even the role of biohacking in the Bible. Hi, friends. Did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/melanieavalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers, use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hi friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body, in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii, not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. The show notes for today's conversation will be at melanieavalon.com/bengreenfield. Those show notes will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about, so definitely check that out. I can't wait to hear what you guys think. Definitely let me know in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. All right, I think that's all the things. Without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous conversation with Ben Greenfield. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation I'm about to have. This is a moment of gratitude because this is a long time coming. Because when I first got into the whole biohacking world, I mean, one of the first people that exposed me to all of this content was the legend, Ben Greenfield, who I'm here with today.
I'm sorry about that.
It's all good. We are here. We are. And so this is a really, really exciting moment for me. And we were talking before, I did briefly meet Ben in person at the Biohack Yourself premiere in Vegas, which was awesome. You gave me a hard time.
I think they called it the Oscars of longevity.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I was actually hosting on the red carpet or one of the red carpets there. So that was fun. You gave me a hard time about having the egotism of having my name in the title of my show. So we match there.
Yeah. So narcissistic of you.
I know. But in any case, so Ben has this book called Boundless. And actually, true story, Ben. So when you first released this book, okay, the first version, what year did you release it in?
I don't know. Life is a blur. I have a hard enough time figuring out if it's Wednesday or Thursday. So Boundless, I guess it was like 6 years ago. So maybe 2019.
Okay. That tracks because true story, when it came out, I think it came out when I first launched the show and I was still having to aggressively like reach out to people and pitch people. And your book came out and I was like, I really, really want to reach out to him. But I was so intimidated by how long it was. I was like, I don't know if I have 40 hours to listen to this book.
You know what my trick is when I'm going to interview somebody who has a really big book? Because I just did this with, it's not that big of a book, but I just interviewed Sahil Bloom, who wrote The Five Types of Wealth. I'm like, every section on relationship wealth and money wealth and time wealth was so good. I'll just like choose one category. So I told him, look, your book's great, but let's just focus on time wealth. Because, you know, my book is kind of chunked into, you know, sleep, detoxification, fitness, fat loss, longevity, et cetera. So I sometimes just approach it from the angle of, you know what, if folks want to read the whole book, they can, and let's just focus on like, you know, one chapter or one chunk.
So that is excellent advice. I was tempted to do that. I actually did read all of it. So I have a million notes, but I did kind of like what you were saying. I was like, in this interview, I'm just going to ask the really random questions from the things that came up that I have questions about. And I will let listeners know that, friends, if you want, which you do want, the Bible of biohacking, everything you could ever want to know ever about diet, sleep, stress, sauna, supplements, literally everything in life, you need this book. And it's so big that when I was taking selfies with it to post later, it took me probably a minute to figure out, like, how do I hold it in one hand and like balance and take pictures.
Yeah, that's the tricky part too about, you know, a book like this, it's kind of a reference book, is I think that books like this, you know, done in a standard way, are gradually going to be phased out now that we're in a GPT era where you could get super up-to-date information on a lot of this stuff with, you know, a quick Grok query. But what I try to do when I'm writing is come at it from a more personal, kind of like in the trenches standpoint. So whereas like whatever, you know, Grok or GPT or any AI model could tell you, well, you know, here are the benefits of, let's say, I don't know, something I'm into right now, Melanie, like haptic sensation for relaxation or turning down the nervous system or light and sound stimulation or PEMF or, you know, I don't know, like gravity blankets. But what it won't tell you is, okay, one of my favorite things to do right now is to go into my lounge and sit on this shift wave chair that vibrates your entire body and was designed to increase HRV because you're wearing like a fingertip monitor that's tracking your heart rate and it'll vibrate in correlation to that heart rate. And then put a light sound stimulation machine above that, pull on a gravity blanket, put on some recovery boots, and kind of create like this ultimate stack that, you know, GPT doesn't know about, but that I'm experimenting with in my Batman cave. So, you know, I try and tell people stuff that they might not get from just a simple, you know, Google query or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. That was actually some of my favorite parts of the books, was when you gave your personal stacks of things. It was like, this is the real, this is the information that I really want to know. And honestly, ChatGPT is probably referencing you a lot anyways.
Yeah. And it's the stuff that, you know, granted doesn't have like long-term human clinical research behind it, but that's kind of part of the fun slash danger of biohacking, is trying things out, seeing how your body responds as an N=1, passing information about what you found off to the world. And of course, you know, Brian Johnson has probably been the biggest pioneer of late in doing something like that, right? And I think brought a lot of interest to the whole longevity, anti-aging, biohacking scene.
Yeah. And speaking of interest, this is really interesting to me. So the night before an interview, I always go and read all the Amazon reviews of a book. This new 2.0 came out, so it doesn't have that many reviews yet, but the original one has like hundreds of reviews. A, the reviews are almost as long as the book. B, overwhelmingly positive. The only thing people seem to complain about, and I find this so interesting, people get upset about it being too much information. And I'm like, how is that offensive? I don't understand. How is providing information to people a problem? Can somebody please explain to me?
Yeah, well, I would say maybe not offensive, but, you know, like inconvenient. Just like when, you know, I don't know, you know, Christmas rolls around and you get 7 pretty cool gifts and 2 new books to read and some complex puzzle to assemble. And you're kind of sort of grateful, but at the same time, you're like, gosh, I need like an extra 2 weeks of my life now to catch up on all my Christmas gifts.
I guess it shows you everything you could be doing and you're not doing. Okay. So like I said, I have just random questions for you because there's so much here. When you decided to, release, you know, Boundless 2.0, which we are here for today, the updated and revised edition, how quickly does the information change? Like when you finished the book the first time, did you automatically already kind of want to update things? That's the big problem about a book, is you're kind of like crystallizing everything into this, you know, physical form.
You know, opening the kimono on the publishing industry, you finish a book, you know, and typically for me, it's a good 6 to 9 months before that book has gone through all the processes from editing to cover design to printing, to distribution, to making it into the hands of someone. So even by the time the book has come out, you know, I'm already thinking, gosh, I should have added this or whatever. I just did an interview yesterday, Melanie, about like some C15 new fatty acid that's apparently the first essential fatty acid to be discovered in 90 years. And it's not in the book because I just found out about it. And so things like that pop up. And as an author, you kind of have to be comfortable with the idea that, yeah, there's always going to be information in the book, especially in a book related to science that's going to be constantly evolving based on research. And then if we're talking about biohacking, new technologies, new supplements, like I was just talking about. So you almost have to accept the fact as an author in more of like the science industry that stuff is going to get outdated. And if you do decide to write a book, you're either going to need to write another one, typically to answer your question directly, in the next 2 to 3 years, I think is a pretty appropriate time frame, or kind of like what I did, just go through and overhaul the first one, add all the new information, take out outdated information, you know, tweak it, reassemble, turn around and have a fresh product.
Are you going to re-record the audiobook?
I haven't decided yet because, well, there's a few reasons. So first of all, a book of that magnitude, we're talking about like 70 hours of studio time. And so I have to ask myself, how much do I value my own voice recording the audio versus 70 hours spent with my family and especially my sons who are 17, who are like, you know, probably not going to be living at home that much longer. And a lot of times I look at life through that lens. I'm like, this is an amazing opportunity, an incredible speaking opportunity, an incredible product creation opportunity, you know, a cool conference I could attend and speak at or whatever. But for me, my family and my spiritual life are number one. And if I have to meaningfully sacrifice those, I usually analyze that decision pretty carefully. So that's part of it is, you know, I haven't yet decided if I'm going to duck into a studio for like 70 hours. And then the other part is that, especially with as many podcasts as I've produced and as much of my voice is out there, AI can do really decent rendering. Like, you know, I don't want to deceive people. I would always tell people if it's AI recorded, but I've gotten some samples back and you can barely tell that it's not me reading the book if we went with AI. The problem with that is right now, and I don't know if I quite understand why. I guess I kind of sort of get it in that they want to make sure they really maintain good quality control. But Amazon does not permit AI recordings, even in the author's voice, of an audiobook right now, which makes sense. But it seems like for a podcaster, you know, who already has thousands of hours of audio that Audible could be trained on, or that, you know, an AI voice could be trained on to submit to Audible. For me, it's like, gosh, you know, I wish I could just have AI do it. Cause technically, you know, it's kind of sort of me, you know, cause it's all the words that I'd say in the way that I'd say them anyways.
It's yeah. Like 3 years ago, I remember I got approached about a company wanting to do that for ads, but that was like 3 years ago. And I was like, oh no. But my mind's kind of changing. If it actually could sound and be me, and like you said, it is us, it's not identity theft of yourself. So yeah, I guess we'll see how that whole world goes. Your kids, 17, do they do all this stuff?
All this stuff is a pretty broad term, but so, you know, my sons, they've grown up in the Greenfield household, and just by the nature of growing up in a household that's focused on health, you know, they, you know, ate sardines and liver and avocado and, you know, not much cereal or sugar from an early age. You know, when we have pizza at the house, it's like fermented sourdough crust with fresh pecorino and maybe, you know, some pears and some, you know, grass finished carpaccio or something like that. Or, you know, and so from a nutrition standpoint, they've always kind of grown up in an environment very unlike the environment I grew up in, which was take and bake pizza and 29 cent hamburger and 39 cent cheeseburger day. And, you know, basically anything my parents could do to feed me and my four hungry siblings without a knowledge of, you know, seed oils and sugars and a lot of the issues in a modern food environment. So they've grown up eating really healthy, and it's just what they've always known. So they don't really do it consciously. It's just like when you open the refrigerator or the pantry in our house, it's all healthy stuff, which I think is one of the ways to get your kids to eat healthy is just like, don't have a lot of other options around. And at the same time, you know, whatever, you know, like I, you know, we live in a little town and I was out and about and they were off doing something. I went into a local coffee shop and they were in the back room having a party with some of their friends eating Domino's pizza. Right. And so, you know, in many cases that, or I would say overall, they're not like super duper orthorexic or like scared of gluten and seed oils. But they wouldn't lie to you and tell you they don't know that, you know, it's bad for their biology to eat Domino's pizza, but we don't really, you know, set down these hard and fast carrier, I'm allergic to seed oils card to the restaurant type of scenario with our sons. And then, you know, as far as like biohacking, they certainly try just about anything that's around the house, right? Like they were in, you know, like hyperbaric chambers, huddled up, giggling and hanging out when they were 6 years old. And, you know, they'll do, you know, the, you know, Roxiva lamp sessions if they're bored and want to do some kind of a light sound journey, or, you know, they'll toss on some BFR bands for a training session or come out in the gym and work out with dad. But they really, you know, they have a card game business, right? Their job is not biohacking and health. So they dabble in a lot of this stuff. And then my wife laughs at me because one of my favorite things is when one of our friends or family members gets injured, because I get to like help them with all the stuff I have laying around the house, you know, it sometimes doesn't get put to enough use. Like my son tweaked his knee in lacrosse last week, and within an hour, you know, he's doing red light therapy with the wraparound red light device and PMF and scraping and a transdermal CBD oil, and then, you know, going to bed with it wrapped in like an infrared knee wrap. So if they need anything, it's kind of at their disposal and they'll use it. But they are, I think it's kind of like the shoemaker's wife wears no shoes. And my wife is like this, right? I go to bed, I pull on my sleep mask and my foam earplugs, and I'm playing my binaural beats and have like a PMF mat under my side of the bed and one of those Apollo ankle bands on to kind of vibrate myself into relaxation. And she just basically like lays down and goes to bed. So, you know, at the same time though, like she probably wears a red light face mask in the morning a lot more than I do. So, you know, there's certain things that she or my sons will do that kind of catch on, but usually not because I told them, but because they discovered it themselves or somebody else told them. Like, you know, my secret is that if I want to get my wife, for example, to, I don't know, let's say, for example, like 2 years ago, start doing a little bit of bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, I could talk to her about it till I'm blue in the face. And, you know, because I'm just her silly biohacking husband at home, she doesn't listen that much. But then if I connect her to one of my cool female doctor friends who has like a phone conversation with her, or I leave a book out on the table and it catches her eye and she checks it out, then she'll act on that information. So it's kind of paradoxical. It's like a biohacking version of familiarity breeds just a little bit of disinterest, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say that was something so I don't have kids. I don't anticipate having kids. One of the reasons I don't want kids is having to deal with, I don't know, just the whole having a healthy mindset surrounding everything is, it just feels like a lot to do. I really appreciated throughout the book all the different tips and tricks and things that like the nutrients kids need to pay attention to more, or the whole section on kids, how they actually need to get dirty in life, which I think can scare some people. Yeah, it was really, really helpful. I actually have a question about kids and longevity. I'm really curious about this. Do you have thoughts on, since the, like for a female, since supposedly, yeah, so basically since the female's purpose is to have kids and, you know, everything is going towards this reproduction moment, if a woman doesn't have a kid, would that in theory increase her longevity because the body's still like waiting to have kids? Do you have thoughts on women and longevity and kids?
You are correct that a premenopausal woman's ancestral, or if you want to call it evolutionary, purpose from a biological standpoint is to engage in pretty meaningful propagation of the species that a man is unable to engage in, you know, and that's why a woman is born with a certain storehouse of eggs, right, to accomplish that purpose. And, eventually she runs out, and there's this theory that, well, once a woman is out of eggs from an evolutionary standpoint, right? They're on very, very rough ancestral terms. She's no longer like handy to nature. And so she should just like slowly die and be killed off. Whereas a man can produce sperm, you know, for most of his life and can propagate the species much later into life. So a man therefore would have better longevity than a woman who's just like, you know, burning through her eggs too fast or whatever. It's a little bit more complex than that though, because if we look at things from a more socioeconomic or epidemiological standpoint, postmenopausal women, and there's even some research to back this up, when given a matriarchal position of caring for the community, of bringing up future generations, of passing on wisdom, wind up with an altogether different purpose in life that I think lends itself to longevity just as much as, say, the ability to or the inability to bear children. So I think, you know, to give you an example, a woman who, let's say, has four children and then goes on to be a mentor and great matriarchal figure in the lives of her grandchildren and perhaps even her great-grandchildren, would theoretically have as much lifespan extension capability as a woman who has zero children to conserve her biological battery, so to speak, but maybe isn't in a position later on in life to have such a meaningful matriarchal role. And you could certainly say, well, what if you have no kids, but then maybe you're an aunt and you have a bunch of nieces and nephews that you take care of, so you could have the best of both worlds? Well, maybe, but I also, you know, and maybe I'm biased because I just love family. I also think that kids are pretty darn cool to have around. And let's just say that you're right. And it does take, I'll say, like 4 years off your life to have kids versus how long you would have lived if you'd conserved that aspect of your biology. I think that the happiness and the joy and the meaning and the connection and the laughter derived from those extra four human beings around is well worth it. You know, and even with a man, like, you know, research has shown when a man has children, his testosterone decreases, right? Probably as some type of a mechanism to decrease a man's proneness to wander and leave the family and move on to other mating environments. A man can start to have a slowing of the metabolism, more body fat, you know, less time to work out, less time to focus on business perhaps. But again, like, just, I would never trade for the world the joy of being a father for the longevity derived from maybe not having kids.
Yeah, no, it's such a valid point. I wonder if a lot of it involves, kind of like you were saying, you derive so much happiness from that, and it's really important to you. And you mentioned the word spirituality earlier and purpose. And so how much of it involves the person's personal relationship, stress, thoughts, happiness from like kids specifically versus not? Hi, friends. I have very exciting news. So I know you guys already know and love Element and understand the importance of electrolytes for hydration, energy, focus, supporting your fasting, your workouts, all the things. Guess what? Element has a product that goes beyond electrolytes. What is it? Well, so I am very pro the benefits of caffeine. I love the cognitive benefits, the longevity benefits. And that said, I am a slow caffeine metabolizer, so I don't actually take in lots of caffeine. I've also learned that the form, dose, and balance of caffeine makes a huge difference in how you actually feel. That's why I am so excited that Element has launched a brand new lemonade iced tea. It's refreshing, delicious, lightly caffeinated, perfect for summer, and what I really love is the science behind it. So instead of relying on massive amounts of isolated synthetic caffeine like so many energy drinks out there do, Element Lemonade Iced Tea uses a full black tea extract, so alongside the caffeine, you naturally get compounds like L-theanine and polyphenols. The L-theanine actually helps smooth out the stimulant effect for a calmer, steadier energy experience with less spikes and crashes, while the polyphenols provide antioxidant support as well. And you guys know I am all about the antioxidants. And the incredible team at Element, including my personal hero, Rob Wolf, conducted a meticulous amount of research to find the perfect amount of caffeine which is the sweet spot for sustained focus and energy without feeling overstimulated or wrecking your sleep later. That is exactly 50 milligrams of caffeine. On top of that, they knew that caffeine can increase your need for critical minerals like sodium, potassium, and magnesium, so that's why Element Lemonade Iced Tea pairs the perfect amount of caffeine with a meaningful dose of electrolytes to support optimal hydration and performance. And of course, Element Lemonade Iced Tea is completely free of sugar, artificial colors, and all the other stuff that you do not want that are so commonly found in caffeinated drinks today. It's built on the same science-backed electrolyte formula that Element is known for, with sodium, potassium, and magnesium in ratios designed to support hydration and energy production. The result? You get your perfect pack of portable, easy-to-make lemonade iced tea that provides steady, clean energy that tastes delicious and actually feels good. As you guys know, Element is trusted by neuroscientists, functional medicine practitioners, professional athletes, including the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, and they're even used by Navy SEALs and the Marines. So are you ready to up your drink level with the ultimate lemonade iced tea? You can get it. And when you get it, get a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase at drinklmnt.com/MelanieAvalon. That's right, a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase at drinklmnt.com/MelanieAvalon. Find your favorite flavor or share it with a friend. And by the way, Element has an amazing no-questions-asked refund policy, so you can try it completely risk-free. If for any reason you're not satisfied, they will give you your money back. Again, go to drinklmnt.com/MelanieAvalon for a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase, including their new lemonade iced tea.
Yeah. A big part of it is I think potentially your worldview also. You know, there's certainly, I think, and I honestly, I have no clue what your political background is, so I could totally be, you know, offending you or giving someone's position incorrectly here. But, you know, I think there is that global warming, depopulation, environmentalist, earth first mentality that says that we should have like 1.3 kids, if that, and that, you know, human beings should be super careful about propagation of the species. And we should probably also build a bunch of spaceships to get, you know, human beings off the planet as soon as possible and onto Mars. And, you know, there's kind of like that mentality. And then there's the mentality that, you know, like, I just want to have a bunch of grandchildren, you know, huddled around my feet, hearing me read a Christmas story, you know, at Christmas time when I'm 75 years old. And, you know, I just love having little human beings around me. And I probably fall into the latter category of, you know, have a bunch of kids, even though I only have two, I realize. But, hey, you know, have a bunch of kids, or at least, you know, a couple or one, and live a really full life and enjoy it. And I think there's certainly a great deal of meaning I derive too from the whole purpose and legacy aspect of having kids. Like, I never really thought about things like, you know, a trust and my insurance policies and a family bank and building meaningful wealth and passing on wealth and wisdom to future generations. And any of those things that kind of turned me into a little bit more of an adulting person until I had kids. Because up until that point, it's pretty easy to have just like a lone wolf, I'm going to do just fine. I don't really have to sock up much for the future because it's just me type of mentality.
I did an interview with, the book was called Don't Trust Your Gut, and it was about data-driven results for things that we might think instinctually go one way, but actually might go another way. And that sounds vague, but basically they talked about happiness in the book, and he found that actually people without kids were happier, like objectively, with the exception that on your deathbed, apparently, like on your deathbed, people without kids are like, I should have had kids. But I'm like, up until that.
Right. And that, I mean, that is a pretty big potential regret to have.
Probably the type, though, who, you know, don't want kids. So I'm assuming that's not people who wanted kids and don't have them. It's probably people who didn't want kids and don't have them.
Yeah. If you look at Harvard's longest study on longevity, in which they took a bunch of Harvard men, I think it started in 1938, and they, you know, they followed a few hundred men for something like 80, 85 years, you know, isolating for all other variables. The most important thing when it came to longevity was relationships. And while that doesn't necessarily have to mean your own children, I think it does speak volumes about just community friendships and potentially family in general. And then if you look at the original, you know, Dan Buettner work in the Blue Zones, despite there being some controversy around, you know, birth record data and, you know, was there like a plant-based agenda around some of that, et cetera, you know, the initial six factors identified for a long and happy life were not smoking, low-level physical activity throughout the day, like I'm literally walking on a treadmill while I'm talking to you, just to kind of replicate that in a, you know, in a modern indoor environment, consumption of legumes. I'm not a huge refried bean fan myself, but I think the idea there is like low glycemic index, nutrient dense diet, wide variety of plants and herbs and spices. And then the last big two were quality of your friendships and connection to family. And so, you know, I think there's probably some other studies, like you mentioned, that might show that having kids could, or not having kids could increase one's happiness. But I think it's a different kind of happiness. You know, I think it might be a little bit more of like, you know, again, not wanting to offend anyone, but like almost like a little bit more of a hedonistic, selfish happiness. Whereas when you're giving yourself away to a tiny human being for at least 18 years and probably beyond that, there's a different kind of happiness that you get out of that. It's like a similar type of happiness you might get from volunteering or service work or charity versus the happiness that you might get from being out, I don't know, clubbing and dancing with your friends and having a martini, right? There's kind of different forms of happiness. And I would say the form that comes with family and high quality community relationships might be a little less hedonistic and perhaps even a little bit more stoic, you know, less Epicurean form of happiness. But I, you know, I've chosen that form of happiness personally.
So yeah, two thoughts there. One, I guess the form of happiness I've chosen is career, like career purpose happiness and creating things, just not creating kids, but creating other things. I'm fascinated by the altruism. Is that even possible? Because if you really step back, it's like whatever you do is releasing a neurotransmitter that makes you feel good. So how is it different doing something that helps somebody else and experiencing that neurotransmitter versus doing something that seemingly just benefits you and you experience that neurotransmitter? Like either way, you're experiencing you're doing it for the neurotransmitter, maybe in the end. It's a complicated topic.
Yeah. And when it comes to family, I think there's something about the biological DNA sharing component. I think that even though this is getting a little bit more woo and esoteric, I think that, you know, based on a little bit of what we know about epigenetics and, you know, DNA data transfer, that when you have children, you are creating almost a little bit of like a quantum entanglement version of yourself that you have around. And there's almost something a little bit, you know, spiritually magical about that. Just like, you know, being able to hang out with another version of you. And I think that from a mental standpoint, it definitely made me less selfish. And I think makes me less concerned about like living as long as possible, because there's this built-in legacy and propagation of myself and kind of like future greenfields that's going to continue after I die. And I don't use that as an excuse to, you know, just like, you know, sit around and smoke weed and eat Cheetos all day, but it doesn't make me as like desperate to live as long as possible. I think that combined with the fact that, you know, I'm also a Christian and I believe in eternal life after our body passes away on this planet, you know, that also, you know, makes me less concerned about living as long as possible. And it also makes me a little bit less, it gives me a little less FOMO, because there's so many things, especially in the information era, that you get FOMO about. Like, oh, I want to learn to play guitar and I want to read these 100 books. Oh, and also piano. And someday I want to do an open mic stand-up comedy night and I want to hike these 3 trails. And gosh, like, I'm going to die before I have time to check off all these bucket list items. But my own personal belief is that heaven is not going to be like a bunch of clouds and us, you know, sitting on the edge of them with fluffy wings and a harp. I think heaven is just going to be exactly the scenario that we're in right now, except perfect without people doing bad things to each other. And so if you think about that, you know, whenever I'm like, gosh, I wish I had like 30 extra minutes to practice guitar today, I tell myself, you know what? 15 is good because I'm going to be around forever. And, you know, there's going to be like guitars and books and people and amazing food and all the animals I ever want to be around and everything else in heaven. So, you know, I don't have to just like desperately try to squeeze it all in during my life here, you know, in this current body.
Well, I love that. And it's really interesting. So out of the entirety of your massive book, you do say at one time that the most potent tip is, and I'm going to fill in the blank. It's interesting because I recently interviewed another band, Ben Azzotti, for his new book. And he said a similar thing, that the most potent thing, and for what he was talking about was the context of to combat obesity, actually, and mostly obesity. But it was this idea of purpose. I just find that so, so interesting because, you know, there's all these biohacks, all these physical things we could do, diet and all, you know, all these things. But in the end, the role of purpose in whether or not you achieve health and wellness and happiness and longevity is just so important. And I love that.
Yeah, I think purpose, and I would build on that, you know, just by that mindset that we are souls with bodies and not bodies with souls. And I have a whole book about this. You know, I think some people don't know, I write some spiritual books too. Like I have one called Fit Soul, I have one called Endure. And then I have this journal called the Spiritual Disciplines Journal. And in Fit Soul, I talk about this idea that we are, you know, souls with bodies. And therefore, if this one invisible spark inside of us is the one part of us that's going to go on to exist for eternity, then it's the very best thing that we can care for. And if you look at the spiritual disciplines, they're a lot different than the physical disciplines, right? The physical disciplines are VO2 max and lactic acid threshold and mobility and strength and power and grip and, you know, mitochondrial health and, you know, absence of senescent cell accumulation and all these things that we can tackle from a biological standpoint. But then the spiritual disciplines are, you know, journaling, relationships and friendships, family and community, you know, singing, you might throw dancing into the mix, anything that kind of addresses you from an emotional standpoint, silence, solitude, prayer, worship, connection with a higher power. And I think that especially in the biohacking world, we can get so carried away with all these other things. And sometimes I even have to check myself and remind myself, hey, look, at the end of the day, you know, let's say, you know, via all these cool biohacks, I achieve lifespan extension that if you look at the average Greenfield man, you know, I should technically be programmed to die of something like colon cancer, cardiovascular disease, sometime between the age of 70 and 80. Well, maybe I can get to 100. But at the end of the day, I'm still just going to be an old wrinkled up sarcopenic corpse in a coffin. And, you know, if I haven't cared for the one part of me that's going to go on after that, then what's it all for, you know?
Yeah. Actually, to that point, do you think there are any Bible verses that foreshadow biohacking, or do you think Jesus would have been a biohacker? I mean, we know he liked fasting.
I've never been asked that question before. I think that, you know, in the Bible, there's a teacher named Paul. He was a pretty great kind of Stoic philosopher and follower of Jesus. And, you know, he does acknowledge the benefits of physical training. And if you look at other passages throughout the Bible, it's kind of based on this idea that oftentimes taking care of our bodies is yoked to sobriety, discipline, perseverance, endurance, character, all those things that tend to spill into other aspects of life to make us people who are better equipped to serve our life's purpose. And I think that if your goal when, let's say, training or biohacking is to be able to, and this would be my own purpose, to serve others and to serve God more fully, it's super meaningful. And then if the goal is just, you know, hey, I want to achieve immortality and, like, you know, be God or somehow, you know, simulate God by hacking my own biology, I think that's a different way to approach things. And I don't think it's as meaningful. And I don't think that's the way that, to directly answer your question, like Jesus would have addressed biological enhancement versus, like, you know, let's like take care of your human, you know, it's all even referred to as like the temple in the Bible, like take care of your temple so that you're better able to achieve your purpose on this planet without waking up feeling sick and sore and low on energy and unable to love others as fully as you could with a really optimized biology.
Hi, friends. Would you like to have the most epic eating experience? I'm talking eradicate bloating and better absorb your nutrients. If so, you need digestive enzymes. These are one of my most favorite supplements out of everything I take, and I truly cannot imagine my life without them. Digestive enzymes are key to break down your food into usable nutrition and to stop things like bloating, digestive distress, constipation, all the things. That's why I created Avalon X Digest, and you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. You can also get a subscription and save 15%, which you can pause or cancel at any time. Friends, I worked so hard to create the perfect blend of enzymes for Avalon X Digest. It's a full-spectrum, plant-based enzyme blend with proteases to help you break down protein, amylase for carbs, lipase for fats, cellulase for fiber, and so much more. In fact, there are 13 different types of enzymes in this blend. I cannot tell you how many people have told me that when they take Avalon X Digest, they experience no digestive distress with meals. These are truly game changers. And for any of you guys looking to up your protein intake, Avalon X Digest will help you actually break down and assimilate your protein so you get more protein from your meals. I wanted to create the highest potency enzymes so that you get all of these benefits when you eat with no problematic fillers or ingredients. Avalon X Digest is also tested multiple times for purity and potency, comes in glass bottles, and is truly the best enzymes on the market. And again, you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us.
Yeah, exactly. And I was raised Christian, so I was immersed in a lot of this. And I remember, like, the obvious, you know, the verse about, you know, your body is your temple. And I think that relates to all of this. And I remember when I first started following, because I found my way into the whole diet world, first with Atkins, low carb, and then fasting and all the things. And it used to, at the beginning, it really bothered my mom. She would try to use this one Bible verse against me that was talking about people eating different things at the table. And I was like, Mom, in this verse, it's literally saying, like, accept everybody with what they're eating at the table. I'm having flashbacks.
That's actually really interesting that you bring that up. I didn't expect we'd be talking this much about the Bible, but, like, you know, in the book of Romans in the Bible, it talks about not harshly judging others, or even, you know, the way it phrases it is causing them to stumble by refusing to, like, socialize with them or hang out with them based on their dietary beliefs, simultaneously being considerate of others when it comes to, in this case, their own dietary practices. Now, the reason that it's addressed in Romans is back to Paul, who wrote that book. He's specifically talking about the fact that the Jews had a bunch of these customs that, you know, everybody listening is probably familiar with, like don't eat shellfish and don't eat pork and, you know, don't touch the blood of an animal. And, you know, all these things are very precise. And yet a lot of other people who would have been hanging around with them in that day, they didn't have these same dietary convictions. And basically what Paul was saying was, look, like let me give an example. Like if you're hanging around with someone and you're totally into, let's say, the longevity benefits of having a glass of wine every now and again, and yet the person who you're out at a restaurant with, or maybe who's over at your house for a dinner party, has a family history of alcoholism, or a history of, like, father or mother abuse related to alcohol, or they have a lot of difficulty controlling themselves around alcohol, well, then the best move is to sacrifice your own dietary habits for that person and just, you know, whatever, have ketones that night. Or, you know, another example would be if, you know, you're going over to someone's house and they're plant-based and you're a carnivore, take one for the team, make that person feel really special, eat the wonderful, whatever, quinoa, you know, quinoa nut salad that they've made, and just basically don't put your diet or your fitness or your biology above just accepting other people and making other people feel special and comfortable around you.
Exactly. I'm having so many flashbacks because I remember we were reading these verses and interpreting them differently because she was interpreting, and maybe we were both interpreting it too severely in our own bias, because her interpretation was always do the thing that the other, like, always conform to what is being done in the situation. And my interpretation was no, respect everybody's diet. And I feel like it's kind of an in between, like what you're saying right now. You should have been there, Ben. You could have could have helped us out with this debate. And actually, speaking of the wine, okay, I have a theory. So we do know that Jesus's first miracle was turning water into wine.
That's a pretty good one. I wish I could do that.
I know, right? I know. And so what I love about this story, A, I love that it's his first miracle, I'm pretty sure. B, I love the throwaway verse that nobody mentions at the end is when the basically the host of the wedding comments, and I'm paraphrasing severely, but comments that usually at weddings, they bring the cheap stuff out at the end. And he's like, but you save the best for last. So I think this was like Dry Farm Wine's caliber of wine that Jesus turned it into.
Yeah. Actually, I don't know if you're going to ask a question about the wine, but yeah, like the, you know, traditional Jewish approach to a wedding feast, such as the one in Cana, where you're correct, Jesus performed his first miracle, was, you know, once everybody is all liquored up, bring out the cheap wine, because at that point, they're not going to care. And then Jesus apparently makes this amazing, you know, like the organic dry farm wines version of wine for the biohacking community, first thing up, you know, out of water. And the person hosting the wedding feast is just totally blown away. And then it is kind of funny that, you know, nowadays there is kind of like a rift in the Christian community about, well, is alcohol good? Is alcohol bad? But, you know, for me, if I show up to a church and they're serving like, what's the popular brand of grape juice that just tastes like pure sugar? I don't remember if it's Concord or what, but you know, it's just like cheapo grape juice. And the church that we go to has like really, really great wine, you know, for communion. You know, I always think in the back of my head, well, Jesus turned water into wine, and I'm pretty sure that he was okay with people drinking wine based on the fact that he did that.
It's really mind-blowing to me. Like, I don't know how it can be interpreted any other way, unless maybe, I don't know, was Jesus not actually drinking it? But that would not track if he, like, I don't think he would create something that he thought was a problem for people. Like, that wouldn't really make sense.
Yeah, I think that anything is a problem for people. Money is a problem for people. Alcohol is a problem for people. Fitness is a problem for people. Too myopic a focus on your diet or your longevity. Like, there's all these idols that are even propped up in the so-called healthy community. I don't think any of that is bad. It's when it becomes your idol and the thing that you are addicted or attached to that it becomes harmful for you. You know, it's even back to there's this whole debate about whatever, like plant medicines, you know, like whatever, mushrooms or the fungus that preceded LSD or, you know, ayahuasca or any of these other things and where those fit into Christian belief patterns. And my own conviction on those is just like anything else. It's like, don't let it rule you and use it responsibly. Like in the Bible, for example, using plant medicines to divine with the spirit world, to call up spirits and to forge your power or find or like predict your path in life. That was actually referred to as sorcery, as pharmakia, and kind of forbidden. And I think God just had our best interests in mind when he warned us against that, because when you cross, you know, when you pierce the veil and cross into another spiritual portal using high amounts of psychedelics, sometimes there are entities on that other side that don't have your best interest in mind. And I'm talking about, you know, things like demons and dark spirits and things that may affect you or influence you in a negative way. But yet, if you have a creative writing bout and you want to take like a, whatever, like a quarter gram of psilocybin to have an incredible surge of creativity, or, you know, you're tired and you got to focus for the day and you need some energy and you know, pop 10 micrograms of LSD, I think those type of uses are just fine, right? So sometimes it's not the compound itself, right? Because we even read in the Bible that God made all things good. It's how we humans use them and potentially bastardize their use or just use too much of them.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, I feel like one of the most common misconceptions about the Bible is people think the verse is that money is the root of all evil, but that's not the verse. It's the love of money is the root, which is very different thing, very different thing. So, and speaking of the wine, so like, I really appreciate your approach to wine in the book, and you even have your, like you make the comment that you haven't had a hangover in, you know, X amount of years, with the exception of some like men's journal shoot or something. But so for me, like I have my whole process down. I get not upset, but I feel like you mentioned it a second ago that there's this whole like conversation today about alcohol and is it good for you? Is it not? Something I think is so important that nobody is really pointing out is all these studies on alcohol. They tend to lump alcohol into either alcohol or not alcohol, or like wine, beer, like these big categories. They're not looking at the type of it. Like, so they're not looking at like a dry farm wine's organic, lower alcohol, you know, version versus this conventional high sugar, high alcohol with all these additives, like pesticide ridden. Those are very different things to me. So I have my whole protocol and I feel great if I do my protocol, which is like criteria with wine. I do Z-biotics, NAD, glutathione. What all do you do for your drinking protocol?
Well, you are right. When we're talking about alcohol, we have to talk about it in the same context that we might talk about red meat, right? Certainly, you can draw up a great host of epidemiological data on the fact that red meat might decrease longevity or be associated with a higher risk of chronic diseases like, let's say, colon cancer. Yet at the same time, if you dig into the data, there's no differentiation between whether that red meat was processed, CAFO feedlot, red meat consumed at a fast food restaurant along with a bun, a bunch of seed oils, fries, and a supersized Coke, or whether that red meat was consumed as like a grass-fed, grass-finished steak that, you know, whatever you're sous-viding in your kitchen. All right. So yeah, you're right. The quality of the alcohol is one thing that we need to take into consideration, you know, especially when you consider the fact there's, I think, 70 plus different preservatives and herbicides and pesticides and additives that are allowed in a typical California cab that would not be allowed in Europe. So back to the dry farm wines thing, right? Like we subscribe to dry farms. We get 6 bottles a month of organic biodynamic wine grown in soil without a lot of water, which concentrates the antioxidants and decreases the amount of sugars in the wine. And you don't use that as an excuse to drink the whole bottle, just like, you know, you wouldn't mow through a whole bag of these new seed oil free chips. Like, calories are calories, alcohol is alcohol. But still, the sourcing and the quality matters. And if I'm out at a restaurant, you know, and I don't have, believe it or not, I don't put a bottle of dry farm wines in my bag at a restaurant. But you could pay the corking fee and do that. I'm usually not thinking that far ahead. But there are several countries that still do a really good job of organic biodynamic farming methods for wine. So if I'm at a restaurant, I look for France, I look for New Zealand, and I look for Italy, right? And if I want to do hard alcohol, I'll look for an alcohol that has like a high amount of insoluble fibers in it. Like, let's say a mezcal tequila, you know, has agave fibers in it that help with the gut and help to lower the glycemic index of the food that you're consuming. Or I'll do something pretty clean, like bitters and vodka and a squeeze of lemon on soda water. So yeah, the source matters. And I'll get to what you kind of do before and after to mitigate some of the potential toxic byproduct of alcohol. But then the studies that show that alcohol is across the board problematic have a few other issues. First of all, when you hear people say that no amount of alcohol is good for you, they don't differentiate between, let's say, an average of 7 drinks a week spread across each night having a small glass of organic wine with your family versus binging once a week on, you know, on 7 glasses of wine all at once on a Saturday night and getting drunk. You mentioned about me, like, it is true. I haven't been drunk in 16 years, except for that one time I had to test hangover pills for a men's health article, in which case I got like slightly inebriated just to test out, you know, how I felt using these things. But besides that, you know, I just don't drink to excess, but I drink small amounts each day. And I think you could even make a case that the hormetic effect of alcohol, or like small doses of something that would be bad for you in large amounts, has a little bit of a longevity enhancing effect. And I'm not just saying that. It turns out that when you consume alcohol, you upregulate your own antioxidant production. You turn your cells into little endogenous antioxidant producing factories for things like you know, glutathione peroxidase or superoxide dismutase. And when you do that, the cells become better able to handle stressors such as free radicals outside of the alcohol consumption the rest of the day. The same way that, you know, a sauna is going to cause electrolyte depletion and a rise in heart rate and a rise in blood sugar. But then when you get out of the sauna, if you don't overdo it, the bounce back effect of that is stabilized blood pressure, blood sugar, heart rate, et cetera, and even the ability to be able to withstand greater amounts of heat based on the upregulation of heat shock proteins. Exercise, you know, let's say I told you that running was good for you. Well, there's a big difference in the way your body responds to running, say like 2 miles every morning versus 28 miles all at once on a weekend, right? So it's the dose and the timing of the dose, or how much is dosed all at once, that is also a factor here. And then if you dig into the data, I mean, there are certainly populations that should avoid alcohol, right? If you have psoriasis, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, breast cancer, you know, there's a few other diseases that are just like, alcohol is totally bad news bears. But then others like kidney stones, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's dementia risk, and a few others, these actually seem to improve in men who average anywhere from 1 to 2 drinks a day, and women who average somewhere in the range of 0.5 to 1 drinks per day. And if you look at decreased all-cause risk of mortality, if you're averaging about 12 to 15 drinks a month, it appears to be better for longevity than not drinking any alcohol at all, which of course flies in the face of what you hear a lot of social media influencers or public health educators saying. But there certainly is benefits to small doses of alcohol, largely due to the hormetic effect. And yet, as you noted, Melanie, there's still, when you process alcohol, there's still a little bit of byproduct that can build up in the gut and can cause a little bit of stress, particularly on the liver and the mitochondria, if it hangs around. Acetaldehyde is the aldehyde that can cause that. Now, I should clarify that plants, herbs, spices, fruits, vegetables, etc., they all have more form of an aldehyde called malonaldehyde than alcohol does, right? And so you're getting aldehydes all the time. It's not like your body can't handle aldehydes. It's just that, especially dependent on genetics, even dependent on some micronutrient factors like your niacin status, for example, your body may need a little bit of help sopping up excess acetaldehyde. Now, if we're talking about one glass of wine, doesn't even matter. You don't really have to do much at all for one glass of wine. But my rule is, you know, let's say date night with the wife, where it's not uncommon for me to have a cocktail while I'm visiting with her before the appetizers come out. And then we'll do either like a split pour or a glass of wine for each of us during dinner. And, you know, that, for me, that's kind of like crossing the threshold of, okay, I'm going to have some acetaldehyde buildup. So what do I do about that? You mentioned Z-biotics. That's like a genetically engineered probiotic that can digest aldehydes for you. That's a good option. I haven't used it lately, but it works pretty well. You mentioned glutathione. I think you said activated charcoal as well. Those are also pretty decent options, and I like those because if you've been eating out or partying, sometimes you've also been consuming seed oils, you know, other additives in the food that might also necessitate a need for a little bit of extra antioxidant and binder support. So if I'm going out in the town or, you know, a big restaurant or party, I'll usually have glutathione and activated charcoal afterwards anyways. But then I think the one kind of like acetaldehyde digestive agent that flies under the radar, yet if you look at the label of a lot of popular hangover remedies, it's in there. It's a dihydromyrcetin, DHM. DHM is so good at lowering liver enzymes, at processing some of the toxic byproducts of excess alcohol intake, and it's incredible. You take it right after you drink. You can usually chase it the morning after. And this would be anything that puts stress on the liver, right? Medications, pharmaceuticals, painkillers, weed, like anything that you're consuming. When I say weed, I mean like an edible form. Anything like that that's going to put stress on the liver, DHM can really help afterwards. Now, the thing a lot of people don't know is DHM binds to GABA receptors. Why is that an issue? Well, GABA receptors, or GABA, is an inhibitory neurotransmitter that gives you a lot of the feel-good effects of alcohol. And so you kind of want to be socially lubricated and relaxed. That's why a lot of us will have a glass of wine, you know, in the evening, for example. But if you take DHM before you drink, your GABA receptors are bound up and you have to drink more alcohol and thus get more acetaldehyde and more calories to feel the effects of the alcohol. So you don't take the DHM before you drink, you take it after, unless you purposefully are taking it so you can, I don't know, keep up with your friends and drink more or something, or because you want to try 2 martinis off the menu and, you know, you're more concerned about flavor profile than you are about, you know, feeling your alcohol. But DHM would probably be like towards the top of the list as far as something really good for pairing with alcohol consumption. And I mean, in the book, I've got a whole, I think I got like 2 full pages of like, if you really got to go, you know, whatever, hit your best friend's wedding, or you got a night out in Vegas, you know, all the stops you can pull. But those are a few of them.
My goodness. Okay. Now I want to make a DHM supplement really bad. I found if I do the Z-Biotics, wear a transdermal glutathione patch during the night of and a transdermal NAD patch the next day, I actually feel better the next day than my normal days because I did like all the things.
And that holds true, by the way, for any oxidative stress, you know, those patches, those electrophoresis patches, where it's almost like a wearable IV, flying, jet lag, high amount of fast food or fried food consumption, alcohol. If you can pull out that glutathione NAD patch trick, I know they're not inexpensive, but I mean, even compared to, let's say you're really messed up, driving to an IV clinic and paying for an IV and, you know, doing all that, the patches are still more convenient. And like any long haul plane flight I take these days, I definitely got an NAD patch on.
Me too. Do you get in trouble at TSA ever? They've been not about it, especially because I opt out and then they're like, what is this?
I've never had any trouble with the patch or with the continuous glucose monitor. I'll tell you the number one thing that my bag gets pulled in TSA for is I'm a total salt snob and I always have a bag of like really good salt in my backpack that I inevitably forget to take out. You'd think I'd have learned my lesson by this point, but if I don't take my salt out, my bag always gets pulled.
Hey friends, I'm about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com. That's so funny. I just remember I tried to opt out. I did opt out in London and they were not about it. They were like, you have to have a reason. I was like, I just don't want to. They're like, you need a reason. I was like, medical. They're like, what's the medical reason? I was like, I just don't want to. I was like, they let me do this in America. They were like, this is not America. I was like, I'm not going through the scanner. And then they were not about the patches.
Well, the worst country I've traveled in for that is India. Like I have literally had to be like strip searched in India and you know, you empty out your entire bag and then they still find something. And then even though I've learned my lesson about, so I realize this is kind of like geeked out nerdy stuff, but I wear a, like an EMF protective suit when I'm doing long haul flights or really any flight that's longer than about 5 hours. And the fabric that those suits are made of course, block radiation. And so if you walk through an X-ray scanner wearing one of those, you look like a ghost and people freak out. So I will usually stuff my EMF blocking suit in my bag, go through security. When I get through security, I'll just pull it on over whatever clothes I'm wearing. But I also have EMF blocking underwear, and I obviously don't strip those off. And so in India, I literally had to go into like a changing tent, take off my underwear, and they just went to town with like a magic wand in the underwear and, you know, going down by my butthole to see what kind of drugs I was smuggling up there. And so, yeah, the EMF blocking, the EMF protective clothing also sometimes backfires on you.
That's amazing. Well, I will say I'm a very law-abiding citizen in general, like to a fault, with the exception of I've become very good at sneaking in my dry farm wines into like concert, like places where I know, because you mentioned like ways that you order at restaurants, which is the same for me. So like France, Italy, look up the winery, find the organic one. I ask for the ABV content. I taste, like I got my protocol down. But if you're going to a concert, good luck. So I have my ways. One time, actually, it actually fell out of my outfit, like all my wine that I was trying to sneak in. And I'm so honest, like I can't lie. Like I just can't lie. Like our parents raised us that like you just don't lie. So he literally asked me what it was. And I just straight up told him, I was like, I'm so sorry. I was like, I can only drink organic wine and they don't have organic wine here. And he was like, just don't tell anybody. You can bring it in.
Just tell them you're a follower of Jesus.
I know, Jesus. One very last topic I would love to touch on, and it's because I don't think in any of the biohacking books I've read ever have I come across this topic. And not only do you mention it briefly, you actually have like a very substantial section on it. And I'm fascinated by it. And I feel like it's a little bit controversial. And it is the role of symmetry and attractiveness in health and wellness. I know it's a big topic and we're running out of time, but just briefly, A, I'm wondering, did your publishers push back at all on wanting to talk about that? No.
I specifically publish with a company called Victory Belt because they're pretty liberal about what they'll allow in the book and letting you design your own cover and your font style and everything. So they're pretty cool with a lot. And yeah, the idea of symmetry is that, you know, if you actually dig into the angles and what are called the Fibonacci mathematical sequences behind the way that, say, like the human body or tree or flower or a leaf develops, there are certain symmetrical patterns found in nature that light up areas in the brain when the eyes perceive them, related to things like serotonin, dopamine, the hormone oxytocin, wanting you to, you know, snuggle or touch that thing or that person, and even brainwave patterns associated with downregulation of stressed out beta waves and upregulation of, say, like delta, theta, and some of the higher alpha frequencies. And so what that means, long story short, is that human beings are drawn to order and symmetry, especially when it comes to the appearance of someone or something that they're around. This is even why, you know, just to give a really fringe example, like, you know, despite some of this research getting a little bit of flack, if you play water, like super chaotic, you know, heavy death metal, and then you play water, more ordered classical music, and then you freeze the water and look at the ice crystals that form, you actually see more symmetrical patterns in the water that was exposed to the less chaotic frequencies. And us human beings have a lot of water in us, and we also respond to symmetry in a pretty favorable manner. And so, you know, the reason I bring that up in the section of the book devoted to beauty is that I make a case for beauty not being just pure vanity, but it also helping you with success in life, with communication with other people, with attractiveness to, you know, either sex, and with your general success in life. And I make a case that you should actually focus on things like your mobility and the way that you train, and, you know, your waist to shoulder ratio, and, you know, addressing, you know, full body functional training for good muscle development, and the way that you care for your face, and even looking into things like, you know, bioesthetic dentistry for the jaws and the teeth, because it is a little bit of a hack in terms of success in life. Like, as I realized, the reason you probably said it was controversial is it sounds a little unfair because we can't choose our parents, but we can choose to educate ourselves a little bit about how to work out for symmetry, how to address, you know, the way that we breathe for symmetry, how to address, you know, how we sleep with maybe like a mouth guard and some mouth tape for symmetry, and generally how we carry ourselves. And there's a huge section of the book on posture for symmetry. And even the person who might think that they're just born as the most ugly, asymmetrical person, you know, on the planet can actually achieve quite a bit with some simple, you know, beauty and training methods to enhance symmetry. And I think it is kind of like a cheat code for life.
Yeah. I mean, I just was mind blown with that whole chapter. And actually, you introduced me to the incredible Cameron Chestnut. So speaking of, when I was reading that, what do you think about if people got plastic surgery for symmetry for their face? Or is it more causation correlation? Like, it's the genetics.
I think if your paycheck is dependent on something like that, or if you're concerned about beauty, or you're trying to, you know, make yourself more attractive, for example. No, I mean, you definitely want to check yourself if the number one reason that someone might be judging you is your attractiveness, because maybe that's not the type of person you want to necessarily devote the rest of your life to anyways. But it is important. And I think that if you can do a little bit of touch up and you have the resources to do so, you know, I think that that it can definitely help. And I have nothing against it, especially if it's going to help you out with your career, with your relationships, et cetera.
Yeah, well, I love that whole chapter. And like you said, there's literally exercises you can, like sleep exercises, posture exercises, things you can do to change that. So, well, listeners, this is just, well, Ben as well, this has just been such an honor. Thank you for everything that you've been doing for so long. You are literally changing the world with everything that you've been doing. The last question, actually, that I ask every single guest on this show, and it's just because I am realizing more and more each day the importance of mindset, and I'm obsessed with gratitude. So what is something that you are grateful for?
Oh, today I'm grateful for the rain. It's a rainy morning, and where I live in Idaho, and it's a raining morning, you know, the birds and the geese are out and the turkeys are strutting around. You can see some white-tailed deer out in the field. The animals seem to just like kind of come out in the rain, and it's refreshing and it smells nice. And I accidentally left the door open last night and the whole kitchen smelled so fresh and clean when I woke up this morning. So yeah, I'm grateful for a little drizzle.
It's amazing. Actually, I said last question, but now I just have to know, because you said you designed the cover of the book.
I didn't personally draw it, but I said what I wanted on it and had an artist draw the cover of the book. Yeah.
I'm staring at it and I'm wondering if there's a secret message.
Why don't you stare at it for a while and tell me?
I'll let you know.
I'm tempted to tell you there is, just to see how long I can get you to stare at my book.
I feel it's one of those images that like anybody is, you know, is going to find a message that speaks to them. Well, thank you so much. This has been absolutely incredible. I am so grateful for everything that you're doing, and I look forward to all the things to come. You are the best. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Melanie. This is such a fun conversation. So thanks to everybody for listening, and yeah, have an incredible day.
Awesome. Have a good day. Bye.
All right. See ya. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information and resources, you can check out my book, What, When, Wine, as well as my supplement line, Avalon X. Please visit melanieavalon.com to learn more about today's guest, and always feel free to contact me at contact@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.